Today is the 6th of May, 2013. I'm David Caruso. I'm here with Jody Roberts, my co-interviewer. This is our first interview session with Dr. Mario Molina here at the Mario Molina Center in Mexico City. Thank you again for agreeing to participate in this oral history interview. As I mentioned, I'd like to start at the beginning and hear about growing up in, I assume you grew up in Mexico City. You were born in 43.
That's correct, yes. Well, I, after I start, as a child, I had the normal interest children have, except perhaps at that time, it was more common to read and not just to watch TV. Mm-hmm. And so I remember, as I must have been 8, 9 years old, and would like to read pirate novels and things like that. Again, called normal. But somehow or other, I became interested. I ran across some biographies of scientists, and that was extremely attractive for me. Thinking back, I think it was important and quite useful that at home we had lots of books. My father was a lawyer, although he had a private practice initially. He really became interested in academic work, and so he created an institute at the National University here for international law. So he had academic interest, I guess, and as part of that, we had a library with all sorts of things to choose from. Anyhow, that's how I became interested in science. And as a result of that, I guess my parents did notice and gave me some or toy chemistry sets or microscopes as presents, which I enjoyed tremendously at that time.
Can you tell me a little bit more about where your family lived? I know your father was a lawyer. What type of law was he practicing?
His private practice was, I guess, connected with probably with standard issues that companies have, or that sort of thing, but working in with several other friends, and I think running what's here in Mexico sort of routine legal advice or procedures and so on. But his university activities were sort of on the side. That was really just a hobby of his. This all happened in Mexico City, and I. I went to an elementary school, a very small one, which had a more personalized teaching, perhaps. But in spite of that, I remember getting bored, very bored in school. I now understand very well what was wrong, and it's still wrong with many schools, but you have to memorize things and so on. And I still remember a few things I was taught, such as the seasons are there because sometimes our planet is closer to the sun than others. And then, I was still very young when I realized that that my teachers were not very good scientists.
So you realized that early, that they weren't very good at the science you were being taught?
Not while I was in elementary school, yeah. Because of course, once I started enjoying chemistry, that was not at all a subject that was connected with school. Eventually, it became part of school, but it wasn't in secondary school already. Something. Perhaps to add there, other, as I mentioned, that all happened here in Mexico City. Maybe I should add a couple of things. My my mother, my mother passed away when I was 3 years old. So both my father married again, and so I consider my mother, because I lived with her so many years, that not really my biological mother, but the second wife of my father. And she was actually also an elementary school teacher, but she didn't work anymore after being married. But anyhow, both parents and at home, they really sort of supported us. Another thing, perhaps, that was not all that common is that, again, for some reason, we had classical music. Mm-hmm. So I became a fan of classical music since I was very, very young.
What did you like to listen to?
Beethoven and things. We still had, of course, the plastic records in our hands at that time. So it was a big thing when we could buy. I remember we were all very happy. A system, a radio that it was supposed to be high fidelity at that time, but that was great. But I remember it later, not too much later. I was already in high school. I had to make a decision. I started playing the violin as well, because I had one aunt. Who was actually German, but she came to live in Mexico, and she sort of helped me learn to play the violin. But at some point in high school, my parents asked a friend of theirs advice, since I like the violin, how should I pursue it? And they got what I believe was terrible advice, which is, because I was so interested in music and in science, they told him, unless he plays at least 8 hours a day, forget it. I think that was terrible, because of course I would have liked to, and I played a little bit afterwards, but I should have played more just for my own pleasure, and not necessarily to become a famous performer or so. But the reason I remember it is because I was sufficiently seriously considering between music and science that I guess my parents might have asked me, and I might have thought about it, but decided, no, I want to be a scientist, because by that time I had already further developed my scientific sort of taste and so on.
I'm familiar with what things were like in the United States in the late 40s and 50s, right? There was a heavy investment in science and technology. Was there anything parallel happening in Mexico at the time?
No, not really. I think one issue I would criticize again for culture in Mexico is the lack of interest and emphasis on science. Here, and that's understandable, there's been a tradition of putting a lot of weight on the arts and the history and so on, but it's mostly the humanities. And for some reason, science was not something sort of highly regarded, which obviously was a mistake at that time, given the importance that science has had historically, even for economic development, human well-being. So that was a mistake. That actually it's continued. It's never been very relevant, except for in recent years that the situation, of course, is very clear. So the current sort of decision makers in government, of course, are trying to change that. But no, when I was a child, that was certainly not the case. But if I can add a couple of pieces more of information, which is that not only was it not something pushed by the government, of course, it was taught in just in a little bit in elementary school, but not really as a science class without giving it much importance. And then in high school, yeah, there were physics and chemistry classes and so on. But it, as is the case in the States, teaching chemistry in high school has a very bad name. Most people hate it, okay, because it's terribly boring and it's a matter of memorizing things and so on. And so I understood why. My chemistry teachers knew I liked it and so on, so I had a special relation with them. But the other two points. One is, it was also quite normal for children not to like school and sciences. So I didn't have friends that with whom I share this sort of affinity for science, except much later in high school I had one or two friends that sort of liked science as well. And of course it much later, fortunately, the situation did change, so it was no longer a very lonely activity. But I did have one aunt also. My father had a sister, I don't remember, she was older or younger, about the same age as my father, who was a chemist. And I did not develop my interest in chemistry because of her, but after it was clear that I did like chemistry and so on, she became interested and then helped me to enjoy chemistry more, because we did more sophisticated experiments together. She was familiar with the chemistry experiments in college. So essentially we did many of the experiments that students do in first year in college. And I remember we had to go to special stores to buy the chemicals. It was no longer toy sets, okay? And so some of the chemicals were, they wouldn't have sold it to children.
Yeah. Yeah. But
with her advice. And so.
Was she living in Mexico City as well?
Yes. Yeah, that's what made it feasible. So at least once a week we would get together and do experiments, and I would do some. At some stage I was able to borrow a bathroom in my house that was not in use. So I really converted that to a laboratory. Fortunately, that was not. And so that's what I did a lot of.
Did you have any famous incidents in that bathroom laboratory with your family?
Well, bad smells, I guess. Or but no, nothing.
No explosion.
No explosions, no. Just. It was very fun, because some of those were really, as I mentioned, more sophisticated experiments. No, but fortunately I did not have any particular taste for explosions, as some of my friends had, sort of the more glamorous part of it. But the other important thing that happened when I was still very young, in fact, just finishing elementary school, is my parents had the idea of sending us abroad to learn another language. So I'm the fourth in my family, so my oldest sisters, they went to Canada, so they learned English. My older brother, who is also a lawyer, they sent him to the United States, to school near Boston. And they thought, well, German is an important language for chemistry, so they sent me to Switzerland, which was nice. In Switzerland, they have good boarding schools, except, of course, I was, I don't know, 11 years old or so. So at that age, it's not particularly nice sort of to be abroad and be in a boarding school. Yeah. But it was fine. And there I had even more, if you want, affinity. I work more closely with my chemistry and math teachers, because they did realize that was something I enjoyed, and it was sort of the reason I had gone there. So I did manage to do also unusual experiments, but particularly to work closely. I remember in geometry and mathematics, so I had a very good connection with my teacher, because we did things outside the regular class as being something feasible in a boarding school. The thing, though, that was the same as here in Mexico is none of my friends had any affinity for science at all. So that's a school in Switzerland, which recently I've gone back just to visit. And so,
wow.
And so it's nice. Well, this is Czech, but I was sort of nicely, I would say, surprised or received, because it's a well-known school in St. Gallen in Switzerland, but one of the classrooms which they have for children and so on, dedicated to me.
Oh, wow.
Mine also, of course, after
nice.
The Nobel Prize. But it's nice, so they remember that very well. But it was quite an experience, and I did learn, of course, German. I had learned a little bit before with this aunt I was telling you that taught me a bit of violin. I did continue to play the violin. That was also nice in Europe. And then I just returned here and continued with high school. But between that and the help from my aunt, my chemist aunt, I had reinforced my love for science. I had, remember, already decided if at all possible, I certainly would like to be a scientist and do research. I wasn't quite sure whether it's something I could do. I remember as a very young, I thought, maybe I can do this at least as a hobby, but I might have to earn my living doing some real work. And so I was very sort of instructed later that I could actually earn a living being a scientist. So that's all as a young kid.
I have a few questions.
Sure.
Just returning to your father's legal work, were you ever exposed to what he was doing as a lawyer, either in private practice or in the academic setting? Did you know what was going on?
Not when I was very young. Later, after I returned from Europe and so on, I did, because I remember, well, not in much detail, but it was international law and so on. I do remember sort of celebrating. It was quite interesting because he was no longer young, of course, but celebrating that his doctorate, he received a PhD, which was very unusual for lawyers in Mexico at that time, because of through his academic work, but all in with the national university, the National Autonomous University. And so that was...
What was his degree in?
His degree was in law. He became,
oh, okay.
he just received, and in his specialty, of course, international law. Jumping ahead, but that's when I was in college already, but it's just pertinent because my father, being the head of that institute that he created, and again, at that time it was still his hobby, but being the head, he was involved in the university administration. Indirectly, it was by no means an important activity, but he had to go to to some periodic meetings that the university has to manage itself and so on. For there were also some student representatives, and I became a student representative as well, I guess because of my grades or who knows. But I do remember it was sort of fun going together with my father and to these gatherings, of course, with the rector of the university and so on, which was quite unusual, of course, in very different fields. But other than that, I had really no direct involvement with
the
law itself. Yeah.
When you say international law, I know there are lots of... Are you talking about relationships between corporations internationally? Are you talking about...
No, he had a... somehow or other, his one of his specialties was international trust funds. I probably should know more about it, but it's these were legal issues, probably connected with financing, sort of international institutions. And to add a bit more, just the rest of the stuff with my father. Because of that, he was still practicing as a lawyer. So, but he was invited then by the Mexican government, because of his interest in international law, to work for the government. He became an ambassador. He was by no means a career diplomat, and so on. And so I was already in college. That was later. And so my younger brothers, because I'm in the middle, and four, I have three younger brothers at that time. They did travel with the family, and they went to Ethiopia and to Australia and the Philippines and so on. And of course, I was already in college, so I didn't join them. But again, this was a good example for me how something academic, if you want, could lead to this sort of recognition in a very different field, of course.
So just so that way I have the numbers correct, you have two older sisters and one older brother, and then three younger brothers?
No, two younger brothers and one youngest sister.
Okay. And I'm assuming did the younger ones also do time abroad at different...
No, because they did, but that was traveling with the family.
Okay.
Being my father being an ambassador already, so there was probably no need to send them abroad specifically. So, but they, yes, so in some sense that's what they did. Yeah.
I know that your older brother is a lawyer. Did anyone else in your family pursue a specific profession?
My brother that is next to me, the younger one, is a physician, so he became a cardiologist, and just ironically, just last year, he became, I think, the fourth or fifth cardiologist here in Mexico receiving a doctoral degree. So most physicians don't have a PhD. But he does research as well, although he has a private practice. It's one of those things you can do here in Mexico. But in the mornings, he works in a public hospital, and that's where he carries out basically its research, and then in the afternoon has his private practice as a cardiologist.
So it sounds like your family was very encouraging of children pursuing whatever they would like to do.
I guess so, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. What about your sisters?
My sisters, the older sister passed away. Of course, she was devoted to her family, but the next one did study architecture, but eventually she married, and at that time I guess it was less common for women to pursue a professional career, and particularly as it's possible now, at that time with the family and so on, it was quite unusual for a married woman to sort of devote a lot of time to her job. And fortunately, these are the sort of things that have changed a great deal.
And did they all stay in Mexico?
Yes, all of them stayed. My younger sister, again, she went to college and so on, and I guess she likes and works with psychology as an advisor, and she lives in Morelia, so she's the one member of the family that does not live in Mexico City.
So I would assume then that, well, let me ask it this way. Were your parents involved in your academic career directly? Were they sitting you down at night and making sure you did your homework? Or was it more up to you to get things done?
It was more up to me. They were involved in sort of giving me support to follow my the things that I didn't enjoy to do and so on. But no, they never put any pressure in terms of doing well in school or in college or so. And again, it was, what I do remember is just the presence, like the chemistry sets, or books occasionally. So they did pay attention to that. If you want. I also like to build things, and so I was part of the idea. I remember we had erector sets and so on, so it's very complicated.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of thing that they, fortunately, they were they did listen to, if you want. But not being scientists themselves, I had very, very little sort of direct help from them. Mm-hmm. Even my aunt, who was a chemist, it was for fun we did these experiments, and she could be very professional, if you want, but she did not get involved with my studies in any way.
I'm interested to know more about this.
Sure.
Because you talked about the culture of Mexico being very more focused on arts and humanities. Your father's a lawyer. It seems like a very traditional kind of professional family that way. But somehow they were supporting you in becoming this budding scientist. And I'm curious both how you discovered that idea and how you expressed that to them and where they found support for this. I mean, they found chemistry sets and things like that, but it doesn't seem like that's something that would have necessarily been readily available.
I guess the...
They were the toys, no?
Yeah, these were toys, so that was...
Sure.
It was not an uncommon toy. And I remember from my friends that these were not toys they particularly enjoyed.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was not that difficult, if you want, because it's... After all, the university was there. There were a small number of well-known Mexican scientists that were appreciated by society, but so it was not that science was sort of completely neglected. It was acknowledged that it was something important, but it was not really part of the culture. Okay, so I would imagine that it's more through perhaps my father's academic interest being connected to university, and my mother perhaps being a teacher, that they thought it was fine. And my initial sort of attraction for science, it might have been a little bit by chance, but I do remember it did have a lot to do with my fascination with these biographies. You remember, I'm not necessarily very well known science, but by Leeuwenhoek, just discovering the microscope and how he found another world out there. Because I remember I lived that experience myself. I was sick in Mexico. Children had, we have certain infections most children get, and so you have to stay at home for days or weeks, and so on. Maybe because I was sick, I did get this toy microscope, and I do remember some copying looking at the drop of very dirty water, which I had prepared, just letting some lettuce rot and so on. And the enormous fascination I had with a very simple microscope, looking at the drop and seeing it teeming with life. Okay, something you normally don't are not even aware of, or if you have to do it as part of a school homework, maybe it's a way to to remove your curiosity for things. But so I had nothing to do with school, and it must have resonated with the books I read and so on. So that's those are things I remember, those types of experiences, or doing with the chemistry sets, crystallizing things in beautiful colors and see how things change. So it's just this natural curiosity that I now realize, because my involvement more recently with science education, that most children actually do have this curiosity. It's just that we manage in school to normally to fight it in some way. But I was lucky. Somehow or other, I had enough support to do it and then enjoy it.
So I don't fully know why chemistry and not biology or physics. I mean, why was it?
Yes, that's a good question. chemistry was perhaps related to maybe chemistry sets and being able to do these sophisticated experiments. But I was very interested in physics and mathematics as well, to the point that when I went to college, to the university, I was questioning whether I should actually study physics. But biology at that time, it was not modern biology that is more sophisticated and more physics or chemistry oriented. So it was nice and attractive, but it wasn't that challenging for me at that time, because I did not know about this new world of biology, which of course is enormously important nowadays, and it's very quantitative, very chemistry oriented. It was when I was a child, I remember it, however interesting it was, it was not mathematical for me. And because it, ironically, because of all these connections, then I finally decided to continue with chemistry, of all things chemical engineering, because there were no physical chemistry. At that time, physical chemistry was not an option, and I realized I had learned very clearly that that was the one topic where you could do physics, mathematics, and chemistry simultaneously. And in fact, that was correct. I did the right thing there. And I could have studied just physics, but again, I did want to do the chemistry. So perhaps one more piece of information here connected with biology. It's not that I was also very interested in biology, but not to the extent of choosing that as a career. But one example, one of my friends, by the way, one with whom I then later shared some of the chemistry experiments at home, but marginally, he wasn't that involved with it. But his father was part of this group of Spanish intellectuals that migrated to Mexico, that turned out to be very influential. And so I went to a high school where I had a number of excellent teachers, because maybe they would not have been high school teachers in Spain, but they had this very important influence here in mathematics as well. So anyhow, this friend's father was an entomologist, okay? And so I was able, and I was very lucky, to participate several times, half a dozen times at least, in field trips that were college field trips, because he was a professor at the Polytechnic Institute. So those, to me, were very nice experiences to make a professional field trip. And I realized, well, that's interesting, but what was most satisfying for the biologists that were in the field trips is to discover new species, and they were able to name them and so on. So that was all very interesting to me, but I thought, no, I like more the mathematical, the physical part of it.
How old were you when you went on these field trips?
I was in high school. That was after I returned from Switzerland, so maybe 14, 15, something around that age. But it was still very interesting, just the excitement of finding a new species, or even species that were known but were strange, these very large, unusual insects. And of course, we had to go very well prepared because there were snakes that could bite. So, but they were professionals, of course, so we were doing everything the way it had to be with college students. But it was another experience of becoming part of actual scientific research. If you know.
Well, that's what one of the things I was interested in is, you say from a pretty early age you were setting out on this path, you wanted to be a researcher, you wanted to do this chemistry, but I want to know what you thought that meant, since you didn't have a lot of models around
you. That's
right. You had a lot of teachers, but you didn't have a lot of exposure, it seems like, to actual researchers.
When I was very young, that's why I thought I had this misunderstanding that maybe that's just something to do for fun, because it was just too attractive, too nice to be able to earn a living. But I remember that quite clearly. the examples were from the biographies. Okay. So I read a bit more of the, these were scientists, obviously, so they, and that some of the biographies were not, they were not necessarily science books. They were, they thought about the people, what they did, and their problems, Pasteur, Madame Curie, and so on. And so that's probably where I got this image when I was younger. And so I then realized how chemists might do research and so on. So that's probably where it came from. But the actual experience, I only had it in biology.
Do you remember any specific biographies that really stand out? You mentioned...
I mentioned three now, from Leeuwenhoek, Madame Curie, Louis Pasteur. Those were the three that I happen to remember. There were, there were probably several others which don't come to mind at the moment. Maybe those are the ones that happen to be at home mm-hmm. for some reason.
You've spoken about, some of the limitations of at least what your teachers were doing in terms of science growing mm-hmm. up. You had an experience abroad which I think was a bit better right, mm-hmm. in terms of science, math going on at the same time. Did you ever consider not going to university in Mexico for your undergraduate degree?
I sort of did consider it, but it was not a real option I had. The idea was that it was much easier to do that after college. It's not something I probably considered very seriously, mostly because it's not an option I thought I really had. Mm-hmm. So that was probably the.
And so going in as an undergraduate, you started off as a chemical engineer.
That's major. Right. That's
okay.
Right.
How many students were in that discipline in your entering class, would you estimate?
The National University is the largest one, so there were, overall there were 12, 14,000 students at the chemistry college, so it's also larger than MIT or
wow.
so. But at the entering class, well, probably a couple of thousand or so.
Okay. So there are a lot of students going into that discipline. Can you tell us a little bit about how your training went for your undergraduate degree? I know in the U.S., a lot of colleges, even if you're in a science or engineering major, you're required to do a lot of humanities work.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know about that.
Right. That's quite different here. Once you choose a career, it's normally quite focused. If it's an engineering career, then you might take physics, some math, and if it's chemistry, then chemistry course, but no more humanities. So that's something more unique in the U.S., where you have an option to change fields later on. In Mexico, that would have been harder to do. But that's perhaps one reason also that you have many dropouts. Okay. So you start with a large class, and then many students just don't make it. But in medicine, it's even more spectacular. So the large fraction of dropouts that they have. But anyhow, that for me, that was not a problem. I remember doing well, like perhaps was at the top of my class a number of times. But I was. Soon thereafter, something similar experience to the one I told you in elementary school, because I realized many of the classes were very boring and were not really run by experts. I did have a handful of very good professors. Again, one of them was from this same Spanish group. Was a very well-known organic chemist, and so we had some even though that was very qualitative, I still had this physics and mathematics attraction, but that's fine. Chemistry can be different things, and part of it is like organic chemistry could just be very descriptive, in contrast to what we would now consider physical chemistry. So that's one thing I didn't get in college, which is a focus on issues like quantum chemistry and so on. But the engineering component turned out to be quite useful because it was very mathematical oriented and it was geared to the problem solving attitude, which was quite useful. But anyhow, other than this handful of very good teachers, I lost interest in the normal classes, and of course did them routinely and so on. But one special thing, perhaps it's of interest, in college here, particularly in engineering school, in contrast, say, to physics and math, which are quite unusual because there you have students that already thinking of perhaps of academic work, but normally students would study engineering or law or whatever, having in mind the jobs that they would eventually get. So particularly at that time, and still a bit the case, things are set up so that you can work almost full-time while you're a student. First point. Second point, which is also, again, something quite unusual, is not that fortunately, no longer the case. The professors were full-time engineers in industry, except this handful that I was telling you that were very good. So they taught really as a hobby. Okay. And now, of course, I realize why is it that they were not really professionals. They were not academics doing research. They were just practicing engineers. And in hindsight, I realized some of them didn't quite understand what they were teaching. But again, because the emphasis on the molecular components and so on, of course, was not there, and I can see now some of the actual mistakes that we had to learn. But anyhow, the point here is that we had a lot of free time that many students had to earn a living, so they were working that free time. So that's why we had classes very early and then relatively late. And so at the beginning, since I didn't have to work, just fairly lazy, just enjoying life with friends and so on. But then afterwards, I had an interesting experience because I did get together with several friends. And we said, well, instead of getting a job somewhere, let's do something. So we created a business. And so that it's, so I can tell you briefly what it's about. I remember just a little bit by chance that some of my friends who were working full time, they were working with plastic foam. And one of the things I would realize, you have to use a catalyst to blow polyurethane foam, okay? And Mexico had a peculiarity at that time, which is no longer the case, with the trade laws, that if you could manufacture something in Mexico, you could, what we called at that time, close the border. They had to buy it from you. And so this is just a connection. Then we realized, well, this catalyst, it had to be imported. Maybe we can make it. It was actually very tricky, but with the experience I had doing so many experiments, I came up with a way to synthesizing it, and we closed the border. So we had all the foam industry depending on this garage experience that we were doing. But it was great. It was a very good experience, sort of, first doing research, because we really had to do something that works, and second, just seeing how does a business run in Mexico, and I remember the instance sort of getting very worried, but we were able to show them that it worked. And so it was a nice experience overall. And of course, my friends were more focused on the business part, and so I did manage to do the chemistry. I remember we had one of the raw products was ammonia, which of course smelled awful, so we had some big tanks, because after all, we had to make it at industrial proportions. Fortunately, there were no big environmental laws, so we could have this somewhere in a garage in the city, this awful smell. But anyhow, it all worked quite well, and eventually, anyhow, that's an experience I had as a student. But in some sense, it was a consequence of my interest in doing experiments. And it was also a reflection of the time we had in college. Okay? So when I, after finishing, just in connection with this, when I got to get a PhD at Berkeley, I, instead of having many topics like in Mexico, with ironically, you have to take 6 or 7 subjects simultaneously, whereas when you do a PhD, you take 3 or 4 classes at most. But then you have to really have to spend a lot of time with them. So I could see just the very large contrast. But I did take a few classes in the physics, the math classes, particularly when I was at the National University. And so that was already a different culture, okay. But engineers and lawyers and so on, that was the normal way universities were run in I guess Latin America and probably in many other countries in the developing world. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, we got closer to my experience in college. We had to do experiments, but they were more the routine experiments in some experimental courses. They were not particularly interesting, so it was much more interesting to do something research oriented, of course.
So I have, I think, a number of questions. Mm-hmm. Based on your descriptions here. Were there any opportunities to do research with faculty beyond just what happened in typical laboratory courses?
No, and that's another, I forgot, slightly unusual thing is you have you need a thesis, and it's not just like in the US for a master's or a PhD, but to actually get your engineering degree, which is a 5-year college, not just 4. And most theses have in chemical engineering, say they would involve more some business chemistry type connection and some story of something that could be manufactured and so on. But I did take that opportunity to actually do some additional research. So the one place where research was carried out in chemistry had nothing to do with engineering. That was in the Chemistry Institute, and that was a group of organic chemists. It was probably the best known chemist in Mexico, certainly at that time, working with natural products. You know, Mexico was actually quite important. The pill and a number of things were actually developed in Mexico with a combination of American and Mexican scientists. But there are some very well-known chemists that from that school, which I had little contact with, because that's one thing that was separated from in chemical engineering, except the first few years, that was a different career, say as an organic chemist or whatever. And again, more qualitative. It wouldn't be physical chemistry. There were practically no physical chemists. Anyhow, I did find a professor working at this institute and was able to do some research, which was a physical chemistry research, working with gas chromatography and so on, but much more combining sort of my engineering background with chemistry research. And so it was a very nice experience again, because it was original research and we were able to publish something or so. But it was at the very end. Okay, so during in college there was essentially no opportunity. Fortunately, I mean, this is just in parentheses if you want, but I did spend some time in Mexico afterwards. I had already finished and then pushed the obvious sort of academic job of doing research. And so a chemical engineering lab was created and so on. And so that's no longer the case. Now there are most faculty are actually full-time and they do research. So things became much more normal in the sense of a U.S. academic or a European academic community. But it was quite a change. Okay? It was quite a change. I didn't get that experience myself until I had to get it afterwards. No?
Mm-hmm. So part of the reason I asked about that is I'm curious to know more about how you did your research for the business that you developed. I mean,
I still had my, let's see, where did I do? Oh yeah, I'm not sure I still had the bathroom available and so on. But some of that I did in one of these friends with whom we collaborated did have, he was connected with some sort of industry, I guess, or family or whatever. So we were able to use some of those labs. I did not need a very sophisticated lab, but I did require, of course, to use instruments and so on. So I was able to borrow much of that.
Okay, because that's what I was curious about. Because, I mean, you can sit there and do the experiments all you want, but to verify products.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so we had, fortunately, we did have these industrial connections. At that time, we were sort of, we were able to.
So how were you able to convince a host to let you do some of your own experiments?
Well, it was almost for fun. It was something that did not cause any problem. Okay, and they thought, oh, it's interesting. Maybe if it's an interesting idea, let's see if you can do something. But we did not take up much space or we didn't need much resources again because it was very much the type of experiments I had done before. You could just go and buy chemicals and we could borrow some analytical instruments. In fact, from college itself that were used for the routine experiments and so on. So I did not require any unusual facilities, in other words. Yeah.
Well,
of course, the main point there was to, once we had the product and I realized, this is it, because we was able to tell, then to do an actual commercial scale experiment, we knew we could close the border, so we managed to do that. Once it worked, then it was fine.
But scaling up, I mean, just talking to chemical engineers and chemists over the years, you know, scaling up from a bench reaction to a industrial size reaction,
right.
There can be problems with it. I mean, if it's batch reaction, if it's
right.
Continuous follow up.
That's why perhaps I didn't explain. This was a catalyst.
Mm-hmm.
So you needed very small amounts as far as the large industry is concerned. And so, I did it at laboratory scale first. And then it was not too much problem to do it, what for us was the commercial scale, just with very large vessels. Okay, that was a big investment. We were able to, I remember again, borrow money from these same connections we had because they realized this works. We were able to make enough to test it, but they were relatively expensive reactors because they were large sort of stainless steel vessels, but they were coated with glass because we had to dissolve tin in hydrochloric acid or thing. So there was fairly nasty chemicals. Okay. So the reactors were expensive, but the rest was not particularly expensive. So yeah, there were some difficulties. I hadn't thought about these details for a long time, but we did manage with our connections, I guess, to to do that. But you are right, normal scaling up, if you really do it industrial, in some sense, that's what chemical engineers do. So that was closer to our main topic. But for a catalyst, we could get away with almost laboratory scale in large vessels. Okay.
But you said, so it's a group of friends, but you said that all of them are business minded and you're doing the technical research.
Right.
So what gives you the confidence to think you can go in and borrow somebody else's lab, do this research, start developing this catalyst, and then scale it up?
Well, because
as a college student,
I realize, okay, this is, you have to make a chemical that had been identified with the stannous octoid, or so it's an organic chemical, and there was, of course, no literature how to make it, so you had to come up with some ideas and knowing some organic chemistry. So the trial experiments were not expensive, doing it very small scale. So it was okay, well, let's try it. If it works, fine. If not, we don't lose very much. But it was the sort of thing that I thought, I can tell if I have the right compound because it would have these properties and so on. It's an organic salt of a metal, tin of all things, which is relatively expensive. And so once I was able to make the organic compounds and, of course, know that it had metal, then I thought, well, this must be it. Let's try it. so maybe it was an adventure if you when I was lucky, but it was a very interesting experience after all. I do remember.
So another question I have is, again, you're going through a college experience. You took on chemical engineering because you were interested in physical chemistry.
That's right.
Chemical engineers, at least the ones that I know of, when they go out into industry, they're more about problem solving and scaling things up. They don't necessarily do the basic research to develop.
That's right, yes.
So,
but it's mixed, okay. So it turns out, just to change that a little bit, that in chemical engineering we're sort of proud that now I'm going to MIT. Because MIT's Chemical Engineering School is very famous. They did some of the original work with unit operations and whatnot. So it a little bit the culture of chemical engineers is that you have a very well-grounded basic education, and then you can do all sorts of things like doing research or whatever if you have the right education. So that's the only thing I would qualify with what you said. So okay, there are certainly in academia many chemical engineers doing research, some of it very scientific oriented, some other more engineering oriented.
Part of the reason I'm asking that question is you did comment on the fact that most of your chemical engineering professors were from industry.
That's right.
They didn't necessarily know how to teach.
That's right.
And so, but there were some academic chemical engineers that you were learning from. But you still wanted this route in research.
Right.
And I'm curious what you're thinking about as a student in terms of where do I actually go to become a research physical chemist?
Notice a big change. The experiences I was telling you about before, I was in elementary school or just going back as still a very young kid and so on. But in high school, I learned a lot more, and certainly by the time I got to college, I was able to read literature and so on. So I was no longer very naive about that. So I knew where and how academic research was carried out, and of course I knew at that time, yes, we are a little different, but in the well-known universities in the U.S. and in Europe, professors do research full-time. So I knew, I already had the correct picture, and so I already been in Mexico studying chemical engineering, had made up my mind, as soon as I finish, I'll try to get a scholarship or whatever. I was no longer going to be funded by my family and so on. But there were not that many students interested in these sort of things, and so I knew there were probably scholarships available. And so even towards the beginning of college, I already had more or less clear the idea that, it's what you asked me before, whether I consider going abroad. Yes, almost from the very beginning, that was already a goal I had set up. And furthermore, just to clarify a bit more, realizing that I really wanted to do research in fundamental physics and chemistry, that chemical engineering was a little bit of a detour. Okay. Mm-hmm. It was already clear in my mind from the beginning, and I was in fact not far from the truth. I could see that later at MIT, of course, that as a student you have to take fundamental physics and chemistry and even quantum mechanics courses and so on. And so that helps.
Just a quick follow-up. What were you reading that helped you understand what it was to be a research scientist? Were it still biographies, or were you...
No. That was only as a child.
Okay.
That was already textbooks and news and probably some magazines. I don't remember very specifically.
Were there any national journals for...
No, if at all, there might have been international. At that time, it was also quite clear that we had to master English, not necessarily speaking it, but reading it, because most of the science literature of relevant and so on was in English. So there were no national resources, if you want, that were particularly important. In very specific fields, what was no longer my field is natural products or so. But I did have some connection with the very academic professors because of the classes I took in the science department, if you want, which were not official. I just went for fun, if you want, because I realized that's where you could learn, particularly math. I was also quite interested in math at that time. And so somehow or other I did have, began to develop enough connections with the academic world, if you want, to know how it would work. But I don't remember specifically if there were some reading materials that, other than the, in fact, many textbooks, I remember, not many, but at least some of them have biographical notes and give you a sort of more general overview.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was quite useful as well, I guess.
So I was interested in a related question, and I think that was, how did you become aware of the fact that the people who were teaching you were not experts?
Yeah. Okay,
so,
yeah.
You know, how did you experience them and realize there's something they're not telling me?
I realized by that time, to repeat what we were just talking about, I realized that they were not academics, so I might have been a little suspicious. But then I was able to read textbooks, to study on my own, basically. So it was my own studies versus their interpretation, probably with the help of these few really good professionals, if you want, one of them, and more in statistics. So there were certainly some exceptions. But I was able to even to find their errors sometimes they were making, but I remember at that time it was, I might have brought it to in class also, but not very loudly, because the culture was still that the professor, of course, was the one talking, and students were not prompted to ask questions, not much interaction, and even less to find errors, which is quite different, of course, from academia now, but you could picture that type of sort of story. You know what comes to mind? This is on the side, but I remember much later reading some of Feynman's biographies and so on, because he spent some time in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And he had fun or whatever. But I do remember finding a few places where he criticized Brazil's academic environment just along the same lines. Okay, it was sort of routine and students were not asking, or they were apparently not interested, but that was, of course, their culture. Okay. So he went there anyhow. I thought it might have been a good experience, but I was so surprised. What did he learned more in his books, it's excellent, his life experience or whatever, but the science was, of course, not let down in some sense. But it just reaffirmed my impression that it's not at all uncommon in, and probably even in the U.S., except in, of course, in the very best universities, in routine small colleges or so, where research or asking or question or so is not the culture. Okay? So that, but that's quite clear. In fact, I was talking about Germany. It's in part true of Germany as well, which something they tried to change a lot, because there you had the image of Herr Professor was a very well-known faculty and no student would dare to interrupt or ask any questions. So that was quite the opposite from, I'm already here talking perhaps of my experience already after doing PhDs, but because I spent first some time in Germany. In the US, what is excellent, of course, the Europeans are now changing that way also, is that you work with your mentor, okay? Of course, you use first names and so on, whereas in Germany, you would use last names even for your schoolmates, okay? So that's a culture. But I just noticed, because first I told you, yeah, in Europe or so, yeah, that's the way academia works, but the human distance, if you want, is something that was more German style than U.S. style in the universities here in Mexico, except in the science department. There the classes were small, and so you could approach your professor a lot more.
Did you have much experience with English at this point?
The only reading I remember, I knew what I called theoretical English, because in Mexico, obviously, we had to learn. We had English courses starting almost in elementary school, I guess. But again, look, in hindsight, very poor courses, okay, things you have to memorize and so on. Enough eventually to be able to read, but not to speak. So they were not geared to practical English. So you have to memorize grammar rules, things of that sort, of not particularly useful. But I remember, because of my interest, I somehow or other was able to read science in English. Okay. And so that was not a problem, but I did not speak English. I remember when I then much later came to the States, I did have, it didn't take that long, but I did have to learn how to speak fluently and not just how to read. That's another story, but in the U.S., that was in Berkeley, you have to, at that time, for a PhD, you had to take a language exam. And so you had to translate from German to English. And of course, I had just been in Germany, so for me, the problem was to write it in English, not understand it in German.
So I can kind of guess that you decided to do your post-baccalaureate work in Germany because of your familiarity with the language.
That's right, that's right.
But how did you...
And because I thought it was academically also something that was close to the top and so on, yeah.
Okay. How did you wind up choosing the University of Freiburg, and did your interest in polymerization kinetics, did that precede your time at the university, or did that develop during the time?
That sort of developed, but it was connected with my interest in physical chemistry, and chemical kinetics is, since you study the rates of reactions, is sort of a central part of chemical engineering in terms of the more complicated parts of it, if you want, which is to design chemical reactors, okay? So you have to understand very well how chemical reactions proceed and so on. So it was more or less a natural extension of the influence I had from chemical engineering, but this time not with a goal of making it large scale. Not, it was not the engineering component, but just the more fundamental science, how do chemical reactions take place and so on. And so chemical kinetics is, you have to understand how molecules change, how fast they do it. So in some sense, it was an opportunity that I said, aha, well, I can, and plastics, of course. That was still part of my engineering interest, if you want, as I developed in them. Plastics are so important for engineering. But of course, it was a combination. I could do something connected with a very applied field, and yet very fundamental. And I remember, well, in Freiburg, there's a very well-known in Polymer Institute, Staudinger but of course I didn't get to know him anymore because he, I think he had already passed away, but he was a Nobel Prize winner for precisely chemistry, polymer chemistry. So it was something attractive to me.
So that's why the University of Freiburg.
That's right, that's right.
Can we step back real quick? And I want to ask about the Chemistry Institute.
In Mexico,
undergraduate.
Yeah.
Yes. So you spent some time over there because you had some spare time built into the rest of your
time. That's right. Yeah.
And I'm curious if you have any, if there are any names of specific people that you recall encountering there or working with.
Yes, I can probably give you the names. That it's so many years ago, but. Or if I think a little longer, there were three or four professors that I became particularly close to. That I'll give you the names in a moment. Yeah. There was one physical chemistry. His name I do remember. Whose name was Javier Garfias. Because there were practically no physical chemists. He was one physical chemist, but I remember. I could not work with him because he did not have a lab, he did not have equipment. He was thinking maybe it will come here sometime. So it was not practical, the only physical chemist. Raúl Cetina was the one physical chemist also, but very organic chemistry oriented in this institute. So these were the two most closely connected with this the physical chemistry field. And Jose Luis, the name sort of came back. Jose Luis Mateos, he's still alive, by the way. I was very proud because, well, sorry, but he's in the Chemical Society here in Mexico. They created the prize that used my name, so I was proud of it. But it's a prize for life achievements and so on. And so Jose Luis Mateos, who was, of course, I was still a student and he was already a well-known researcher. So he eventually got this prize with my name, so that made me very proud. But he's one example of somebody not in my field directly because he was really an organic chemist, but with whom I did have connections and some advice working in the lab and so on. So these were examples of okay, Ms. Romo, I could give you several few names, but perhaps these three names would be the most important ones at that time in Mexico.
Well, I'm thinking about this time too, because in terms of natural product synthesis and organic chemistry, this time in the United States at least, there's a large shift in the practice of organic chemistry taking place, mostly around the introduction of instrumentation. And you've already mentioned very specifically some work with gas chromatography.
Right.
Was this experience also changing the work that was happening inside of the Chemistry Institute here?
I think so, although at that time it was still very organic chemistry oriented, doing synthesis. Mm-hmm. And it's still a practice in as you know, in organic chemistry a lot, just to know how to make chemicals and to be able to come up with some complex chemical structure by a combination of synthesis and analysis, which you're right, has changed a lot, but they had at least the basic machines, possibly NMR and some others, but it was relatively primitive, if I remember at that time, from what I remember in the labs, which is something that changed. I mean, the chemistry school bought the large NMR and things of that sort, and more physical chemistry oriented, but they did have the basic instrumentation. I happen to remember, as we were talking about names, the name of the U.S. scientist that was, I believe, at Stanford, is Carl Gerassi. Mm-hmm. And of course, he did some of this very important work in this company in Mexico, which is where this had this very strong connection with this particular institute. Nice. So that was just the example. But again, he was not very sophisticated in instrumental analysis, as far as mm-hmm. I remember at that time.
So I do want to hear more about your time in Freiburg and okay. what you were working on and your advisor. But I also I noticed that during your postgraduate work, I think you also held an assistant professorship at the university here.
No, that was just before. See, I okay. had sort of two waiting periods. The reason is it takes some time to get a scholarship. And I don't remember the details, but it's much easier to get the scholarship once you have a degree. So there was this catch, okay, so I got the degree and then I applied for the scholarship. So I was able to, because I was obviously academically oriented also, I was able to work at the National University before I got the scholarship, and I did a trip to Europe, lecturing already, and essentially creating one of the first graduate programs at that time, other than the organic chemistry one, where you could, in principle, already get a PhD. But even that, I remember, was very rare. But I did create a master's program in chemical engineering, so. So that's when the experimental labs were received. They had some, because as chemical engineers we had to do some experiments, but they were not at all research oriented. They were more teaching oriented. So I was able to push for this, and that, of course, times were changing. So that's when at that time perhaps it was a time when university began to change to be more academic oriented, to have more full-time professors, but it was just the very beginning at that time. So I was able to contribute to that, if you want. It was just the right time.
It sounds like there's probably more to it than you just contributed. I mean, it's very nice of you to say it that way, but I mean, establishing a graduate program when you're there waiting for a fellowship seems like a relatively major event. I mean, what was your vision? Or if there are others working with you, what was the vision for what a graduate program, a master's program would be?
Yeah, the vision was a combination of these things we're talking about, but making the chemistry school, which had chemical engineering, pharmaceutical, chemistry, whatever, but making all of it more academic, hiring. Of course, at that time also there was a problem with the salaries, but that all was part of the change, hiring full-time professors and doing research. Mm-hmm. And so I remember just pushing, well, you have to get people involved that are finding out new things here at the university. Okay, just like I had the example, look, we do have this organic chemistry center, which, by the way, that this is also something fortunately changed, but it was in my mind. that chemistry institute with this very well-known chemist's connection with Gerasim was completely separated from the university. None of them taught any course practically, or maybe they taught one or two. So it was sort of quite a waste having the potential to do research and so on, but they had to, in some sense, I remember, they wanted to be sort of isolated from.
So what was its purpose?
To do research.
Just to do research.
Right, because 14,000 students or so, if they saw teaching more as a burden, okay, because if you had so many students, you had to spend so much time. We want to spend full time doing research because it was so disconnected from teaching. There were practically no students helping them. They were all individually doing their things, in spite of the 14,000. Okay. So it was a very different image. You see how things... So that was also part of my push together with us. Well, let's see whether we can change all that. And of course, this institute, by the way, is still there, but it's, of course, much more closely connected with the university now. But yeah, those were different times. But I forget, you were asking me...
About the graduate degree.
This was sort of the beginning, was the right timing, and I probably helped.
Well, the right beginning, but I think, what's your model? You're building a graduate program and you're just finishing your bachelor's degree. Where do you, what gives you the, what makes people in the university administration believe that you can even do any of this, since I can't imagine if I was graduating from college and pitching a graduate program that they would have listened to me. They would have taken note and put it aside
okay.
after I left.
Yeah.
But you're also, I assume you're looking for models of how the graduate programs might work.
I do remember two things, again, for people. There was one of these teachers I was telling you, which was... in fact, he was not of Spanish origin, although he was very closely connected with the Spanish community, which was Madrazo, was his name. He was very academic-oriented and became the chairman of the chemistry school. And so he was a lot of help because he had, of course, because of his academic interests, we shared that vision of how things had to change. So I had some sympathetic... years, if you want, with some professors that fortunately were able to, they had in sufficiently important positions. And in fact, some others, the previous chair was from the Chemistry Institute, a bit of an exception, somebody that decided, okay, I've done enough research, so I'll do some. So we came, he had to spend quite a bit of time as an administrator because just of the sheer number of students and things to do. Okay, so that was one example. A handful of, which was certainly not the majority, but a handful of professors or people working there that, of course, recognized the need to change. The other thing I do remember is that we were able to invite a few well-known foreign professors. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, and I might have the times a little bit scrambled because I'll have to look it up in detail. But anyhow, I remember we invited some well-known German professors, and I had a great time with them. They were more they were more organic chemistry oriented. So I remember doing some field trips with them and. And they offered a lot of help and so on. It was a little bit part of the help going to Germany. But also what was quite important, turned out to be quite important, there must have been some connection so that we did invite, and he came afterwards a couple of times, a chemical engineering professor at Berkeley, whose name was Vermeulen, Ted Vermeulen. A very nice person, of course. He was a student, he was a full professor and so on, and he came to give us some lectures. That was great. But we were able to work sufficiently close with him I even remember having this time, yes, some discussions. He had some ideas had to do with chemical kinetics, and I said, well, but what about this and that? And he got sort of excited. So it was nice to interact with somebody at that level. But this became important because there was this small group of us, several other friends who were a little bit younger than I was, because the difference is I went to Germany, spent there a couple of years, whereas these other friends were just coming out. We were admitted to Berkeley, okay? That was unheard of. There were no Mexicans. I mean, who would admit a Mexican student coming out of this type of school like I was criticizing, okay? But this professor, I mean, they're having interacted with us. We had certainly the doors open, and so that made it feasible to be admitted to Berkeley's graduate school, and that's why I chose chemistry. Of course, my friends went to do chemical engineering, several couple of them, and so on. They were around three or four, but in fact, one of them, they're still very good friends of mine, but one of them became rector of the National University, so right. These were people that are well known.
So I think now would be a good time to return to Germany.
Okay.
Can you? So you were going there to do postgraduate work. Was mm-hmm. this some sort of equivalent of a master's program?
It was open. Yes, I remember, it's something I didn't have very clear whether a master's was a requirement for a PhD, but it was clearly graduate school. Mm-hmm. And I do remember it was just my experience. It was nice. I was able to do experiments and so on. The one thing that was sort of missing, which I realized from whatever I knew, even knowing Ted Vermeulen and so on, is this closer contact with the professors. You have to do things on your own, and you didn't have that much access to the professor. And you could go and sit in some lectures, perhaps. But for me, what I, at that time I had realized already is that what was missing in my undergraduate education was more the physics, the quantum mechanics, the much more sort of molecular perspective, which, by the way, now is a very integral part of chemical engineering. But at that time it wasn't, not even in the U.S. That became sort of slowly a very important part of it. For example, for chemical engineers, again, catalysis is terribly important. So you have theoretical chemists working in chemical engineering departments nowadays. But in any event, the German system was not easy to take advantage of. And by that time, of course, I became much more aware, and I knew more details about how research was carried out. And so I decided sort of halfway, look, I think for this interest I have, I'm going to change. I'm going to go to the States. This time here in Germany is not wasted, but I much prefer this environment in the U.S. for a PhD, where you work very closely with a mentor, and where I would have the opportunity to formally take courses in physics, quantum mechanics, some mathematics still, that I had missed as a chemical engineer in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be correct, in fact. So I fortunately did have enough information so that it actually happened that way. So in the U.S. I was able to take this course. I was able to work a lot more closely with my mentor, George Pimentel. And I don't regret having been in Germany, but it was a very different experience. In hindsight, it's possible that if you do very well in your undergraduate courses, you already know what you want to do and so on, and you don't need much advice, you're not changing field, that you can do a great PhD. But it's a lot harder, or it was a lot harder under my specific circumstances. So it, again, that was my my time in Germany. In fact, it was not even required, or with it being doing research, you could just be all day in the lab and doing routine things without even taking courses. Because it's only a formality when you're an undergraduate and so on. And taking courses, you could just go and listen to a professor. It was not interacting with him. And again, I became aware, of course, in Germany, they were trying to change a lot of things, but I didn't get that change myself. So that was my experience in Germany. Basically, at some point, it was again waiting to get admitted to Berkeley and to get a scholarship and so on. So I had some time.
So that's what I was going to ask. So did you stop doing what you were doing in Germany before you had received acceptance to a graduate program? Or
yes, because I realized I need to now pay full-time attention to getting admitted in Berkeley. So it was just a matter of timing, I remember, because you have to apply almost a year ahead of time. So I did something also unusual. I had done something in Mexico in between, which we talked about. But this time I said, okay, why don't I want to remain in Europe but have a different experience, so I went to Paris. Because in the Sorbonne, they also had a chemical, a polymer institute, which was similar. And I thought, well, I had decided not to get a PhD in Germany because of these things we talked about. So having decided that, I said, there's no advantage for me to remain another year in Germany if I am not pursuing the PhD. So why don't I change course and see how things work in Paris? It turns out from an academic perspective, it was not all that different. You have very big classes and you could listen, you could do work in the lab, but it was just very easy to get admitted to the Sorbonne. So I was admitted to the Sorbonne with just as a graduate student, but did not have, it was in my mind, of course I didn't tell that, but in my mind, it was just a waiting period. And it was, if you want, a time in my life there where I realized, well, I can do much better studying on my own. So I ended up studying math and so on. I mean, but had a lot of time, of course, at the very interesting moment in students' life, because that was in the 1968, 1967, with all the student unrest. So I was just able to participate. I had a good many friends in Paris, where I had a sort of an important component in politics, cultural life, and all the things, and did not neglect the science, but the science was essentially on my own at that time, because I realized there's not that much I can do at the university other than, the reason is the following. It would be the same reason I decided not to remain another year in Germany. I could have started the research project, but it didn't make any sense, okay? Mm-hmm. So it was already applied to Berkeley and so on, and had good prospects, knowing that for me also, it was essentially just saying, look, I have this opportunity, I learn about all these other aspects of life as well, and learned some. I remember I was, I realized I had to learn more, essentially math at that time, of the physics as well, which was useful then to get me ready to actually do the PhD in Berkeley. So it was more or less along these lines. So I did not give up, as I'm thinking back of those years, I did not give up my goal of becoming a research scientist and so on. I just did what I think in hindsight was actually the right decision. I think I can do it much better in the US, given my specific background and the changes I wanted to undergo. And so that was it, essentially.
Were the classes conducted in French?
Yes, yes, of course.
And
yeah.
You were...
Yeah, I French for German was much more difficult, of course. What I had learned, I did learn, one thing I did is take some French courses as well, but that was not particularly, I could understand. A bit more of a challenge was to speak, but there was not very much problem just attending the classes. I don't remember when if I started to learn French. Probably when I was in Mexico, I might have taken some classes. Yeah, there is an instance here, the Liceo Francés, or somewhere where I don't remember just going to take some French lessons just for out of general culture, if you want. It was not very scientific at that time. French was a very important language in Mexico at the beginning of the 20th century, if you want, because all the sort of European influence.
Hmm? Porfirio Diaz.
Right.
President
right.
That was very, very interested in French culture. They're staying at the Hilton in Reforma. You're right in front of a very large white marble building,
mm-hmm.
Beautiful. All that type of architecture in Mexico was started at the late 1700s, early 1800s with that president.
Mm.
He was
yeah.
in power for 30 years, and those 30 years we had all type of French influence.
French influence.
He was very Mexican, very Mexican. He's very interested in France for some reason.
The U.S. has presidents like that as well.
Yes.
Who love their French architecture.
Yeah.
So
right.
The only other piece with the time at, in Paris at the Sorbonne, you mentioned kind of briefly the student protests.
Right.
What was your experience, your take on being there at that time?
Well, I do remember being part of it with Jean-Paul Sartre and all that. And besides, of course, reading or learning math, as I was telling you, there was all this cultural component, which it was not something that we were talking initially in Mexico. Once you go to college, you don't do that. But it was part of my general cultural interest, if you want,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, is something much more recently I've reinforced a lot more in terms of history, of course, even teaching, okay, there's all that cultural component which is very important, which you could easily neglect if you are single-minded scientific research person that only works about your own specialty. Right? It's obvious that you need to do things right, all sorts of interactions with other fields. So in some sense, that was a beginning of that experience. It, because it was also cultural, of course, the cultural life in Paris was very active at that time, not just concerts, but theater and things. But there were student unrest. You could go to the streets and participate and read about it all and go and see what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
There was also I did have interactions also that I do remember that was, in fact, quite interesting and important. There were a number of Mexican students in Paris at that time, and of course, being Mexican, we were friends, we got together. But none of them were scientists. They were all in other fields, and several of them became very important afterwards. Foreign relations minister and so on was there at that time, and so because they were part, we were young, they were part of that generation. But it was again this we call it in Spanish vivencia, or this living something rather, experiencing something in actively and rather than just reading about it, and it was discussing politics and discussing these issues with students and so on, and literature, of course. And so it was I was already interested in Latin American literature and so on. So that it was an interesting time, which is, in hindsight again, it was not bad because I had to change quite drastically then going to Berkeley, because getting a PhD in Berkeley and changing topic a little bit, I had to devote full time there to the stories, except for the little bit in Berkeley was also the time of student unrest, okay? So I didn't have to spend a lot of time because you could just see that. But I didn't have time to read literature or to go to the theater or to do the sort of things I could enjoy in Paris. Yeah. So it was fun.
Were you ever tempted while you were spending this time in Europe to rekindle your music career?
Yes. And in fact, I did something which might have been right. I switched to learning guitar because I thought that might be easier. That's probably a mistake. It's not any easier than I used to. But I did learn to play classical guitar, so that was, I also like Spanish guitars. And again, just for my own, I regret very much, but I couldn't keep that up in when I was in Berkeley and so on. So I certainly retained my great interest for music, but more listening and so on. Maybe I'll take it up again, because I just doing music, to tell you more, the last bit of really enjoyable music I did was still in Switzerland when I was a young student, still taking classes, because I did get to realize how wonderful it is to play. I played well enough, if you want, I was very young and so on, to join a student quartet or so, to play with others, okay? So when you do music and you are part of a group and so on, then it becomes a very unique experience. So that's what I remember, and I regret, because I have looked at several examples of scientists that, like, including Einstein, of course, is the best. Now, he was apparently not all that good, but anyhow, but he did like to do, and at MIT, I had a few friends, professors. So those who could keep up their interest to the extent that they play an instrument, it's something I regret not doing that. But anyhow, that was that part. But I always kept listening to music very actively. That I do remember taping all sorts of things in Paris. Yeah.
I know you mentioned, you had this interaction with a Berkeley professor. Did you consider applying to any other American universities, or was it just Berkeley?
No, not really, because Berkeley was very well known, and we had this connection. I thought there were some, we were sort of vaguely familiar with some other ways to get a scholarship, where you just got the scholarship and then you were assigned some college somewhere. I thought, well, that doesn't compete at all with Berkeley. So once we had the connection, then I became confident that we were going to be able to do something, and indeed, so that was not very difficult afterwards. The only thing I remember in Berkeley, again, I must tell you about the misconception I had from Europe, is I applied as a master's student, because I thought that was a requirement at the time. And then, of course, in Berkeley, you get a master's a little bit as a, if you, for PhD students that cannot make it, okay, we'll give you a master's, okay. And so, but it was very easy for me to change to what I had to, I mean, they asked me, do you really want, of course, yeah, it was just a misunderstanding that it was easier to get admitted as a master's student, but again, in the academic departments in chemistry and so on, there are relatively few master's students or students that apply that way.
I want to know a lot more about your time at Berkeley. The one question I'm also curious about, you spent time living in lots of different countries with different cultures. You mentioned that you had a reading knowledge of English, but you weren't necessarily conversational.
That's right, that's right.
Was it difficult, was there culture shock coming to the United States, or Was it just the language barrier for you?
I think it was just a language barrier, and it was not a big deal at all, because again, I did understand. I just remember the fact that I was very fluent in theoretical English, I was mm-hmm. calling, because I had no problems reading any science textbooks or so. And then I realized, hey, but it's different to really communicate, and it's sort of funny that probably the English teachers I had in Mexico, none of them spoke English really. So that was part of the, they were just teaching normally. But no, that was not an issue. Essentially, the language barrier is something I probably took relatively little time. Mm-hmm. And I do remember, but there were a few funny things or so I had. I joined Pimentel's group at the same time as another student from, I believe it was New Zealand, and we could barely communicate. We had such a I couldn't understand old English. Okay? It took a while before we could. So that tells you about my limitation, but American English was relatively easy. And no, the culture, it was thing to note there, I was again in an academic environment. Okay? Mm-hmm. So, and this, it was interesting because in Berkeley there was People's Park, lots of hippies and so on. So it was interesting, unusual sort of, and not particularly a cultural experience, because the hippies were very primitive as one thinks of them, and just of singing and so on. But there were things going on that I went to a few. Again, I didn't have much time, but there were always interesting people that were invited that you could go and see. But I didn't have much time to go to concerts or anything. Anyhow, I was listening to music on my own. But I knew more or less what to expect, if you want. And again, in academia, if you look at it, inside again, it can be quite a different cultural experience than if you go to some small town in the south or so. That would have been a cultural shock, I would imagine.
So starting your graduate career, I'm assuming that Berkeley had you taking courses?
That's right. That's right, yes.
How are those courses different, or were they different from what you had experienced previously in your other?
Yeah, they were different, but it's what I was expecting, in that you really had to put a lot of time, and it was the homeworks, but also the interaction in class. They were graduate courses, or relatively small courses, relatively small classes with students, and it was just much more active. I mean, I was able, remembering back in Mexico, so I tell you to take it very leisurely, because they were not very demanding, okay? You just had to do the routine things. But I knew there you really had to understand what you were learning, and I was taking demanding courses, okay? I did take, some sort of upper division or graduate math courses, and there again, that was not easy, because you had to participate quite actively in those courses. And it was a lot of work, but it was very satisfying. I was worried, will I be able to change field and do this? Fortunately, I was rewarded, if you want, because in the courses, you also get the feedback, okay? If you just listen to the professor, eventually perhaps you have to do final exam, well, maybe you get lucky or unlucky, but if you have a much more active participation, then that's much more rewarding, but it's a lot more work, okay? Mm-hmm. So I had maybe 3 or 4 courses at the beginning, which was a lot for a graduate. I on purpose, and I did talk to my professors that it was all right. I was on to take a bit more time at the beginning than a normal graduate student because I didn't want to take these courses, and that worked all right.
Were you doing laboratory work at the same time?
Well, the laboratory work was when I started doing the research.
Okay.
So I started, and again, I was able to postpone it at least one semester or something like that. And then I really became integrated in a research group with Professor Pimentel, and that was essentially full-time. Well, I could still take one or two courses, but at that stage it was full-time research, original research.
Did you get to choose what lab you wanted to go into?
Yes, yes.
How did you choose Pimentel's lab?
Because I chose based on what I knew the different professors were doing research in which topic, and again, it was something with a very fundamental physical chemistry connected also with the nature of chemical reactions. And I had several options. There were some very good people, but to me it was quite attractive, the type of research that Pimentel's group was carrying out. He was also very well known in education, so had some very important textbooks. And so it was an attractive group to join. In some sense, I was a bit surprised, if you want, but I had no trouble being admitted to the group because each professor only takes a couple of students each year. But I was lucky or had the choice. But that's also later on, of course. I really, being a professor myself, you talk to many students come and see you, you talk to them, and some of them choose to work with you. And occasionally, the student doesn't get his first choice, and then he goes somewhere else. But I was lucky, so I joined the group I did want to do, which was experimental research, but with very fundamental chemistry, having to do with the nature of chemical reactions.
So there were 8 or 10 graduate students in his lab at any given time?
He had a large group. He was probably more like 15 or so. Okay. No, I take it back. Maybe 10, but he had 5 postdocs and maybe 2 visiting professors. He was a very well-known person already at that time.
And did he give you direct attention once you got into lab? I know some professors, they're busy with their research, and they don't necessarily have a ton of time to work with graduate students.
There were 2 things that happened. One, I did work with a postdoc that was there closely in terms of the experimental details, so I was able to sort of learn from him. But we had very regular group meetings, and in the group meetings it was a program. Everybody could talk and so on. And then, besides the group meetings, we had something like at least a weekly meeting with just myself and the professor. So it was set up to have very close interaction at that level. And you're right, there are all sorts of different personalities. There are some professors that every day go to the lab and see, but more to push you, see whether you produce something or not. And some others tell you, because I remember afterwards having fun with some of my physics friends, they tell, okay, here is your, a little bit more like German, this is your research project. Come and see me at the end of the year and see what you... So everything goes, but the normal, the most productive thing, most good professors were that way. You had a fairly important interaction quite often with a group at large.
How big
and
was
with
the
professor.
Research? How big was that research group?
Well, the group, again, it must have been 15, 18 people or so. And again, some visiting professors, postdocs, and graduate students. But once you're there, there was no difference. We were all the same in some sense, except at the very beginning we were shy and learning how things work, but very rapidly you could get integrated. Yeah.
Were you assigned a project or did you develop a project with Pimentel?
No, it's quite open. I was assigned the project as a result of talking to him, because in some sense there might have been a few options, but with the idea that the project could evolved, and then you could talk about it in change direction a little bit. I didn't have to change more. The project at large was working with chemical lasers, which was something precisely that Pimentel had found with one of a German visiting professor. In fact, they discovered the first chemical laser just shortly before I arrived, maybe a year or a couple of years or so. And then it became clear that you could learn a lot. It was not applied research in terms of developing lasers based on chemical reactions, but using the laser emission as a tool to learn about the reactions. So that's what I essentially chose and did as a research topic.
So molecular dynamics.
That's right, that's right.
And so using chemical lasers is a relatively new research area at this point.
That's right.
So yeah,
it was very new because lasers had been sort of discovered not that long ago. Mm-hmm.
So
remember,
was that,
yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
No, this is just an aside.
No, tell me the aside.
It just came, but it's, of course, Charlie Towns was at Berkeley that I remember going to his lab. Of course, I didn't meet him, but was very envious in Berkeley that he had a space assigned because he was a Nobel Prize winner. So could, and it's fun because later we became good friends. Okay, he's very approachable. So I got to know him very well. But imagine at that time as a just arriving, and this is just in passing, but why not? I mentioned let me spend half a minute because it's sort of fun. I was just at a meeting in PCAST at the National Academy, and so we were worried about Congress, some congressman who should have taken science in elementary school but didn't. But they wanted to impose some restrictions of NSF. That NSF would have to guarantee that the research was for the benefit of the nation. So it's just crazy. I mean, that's, you have the peer review system. But it's very easy to find names of projects that are very weird. Okay, so how the hell can they get? And so we chose Charlie Towns because he had a very academic, very unusual name for the research he was doing. There was Masers and whatnot.
Yeah.
Just as a classic example of something, they wouldn't have the foggiest idea what he was talking about. And that's nothing less than the laser, okay, which we use every day in so many things. So it's sort of a perfect counterexample of something that you expect to be applied immediately. No, that's not the way research goes. But anyhow, it goes back to Berkeley, to those times when the laser was just coming up to speed.
So this PCAST meeting must have been very recent because
this one was just last week. Yeah, sure.
That congressional proposal was just made, I think, a week or two ago.
That's right. We were going to write the letter or something. We were going to complain very much.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you'll be doing that in mass. So was there a particular interest in working in this area because it was so new?
I guess so, because it was new and interesting, because it was a new tool that still had to be developed and that could provide you with some insights into chemical reactions that were unique or so, which in fact was the case because we learned a lot. I mean, it worked in some sense that we were able to do original research. Okay. Mm. And so, but again, this is going, it took a while, of course, but if I start from being interested as a child and then doing things in high school, in college, learning about it, but then it was really at Berkeley that I could, for the first time, was something new in research, create something or learn something that had not been learned before anywhere, and be able to write some original research. That's, in some sense, that's the experience I was looking for since I was a child, and it did materialize while doing the PhD. So was quite interesting, no? That, and that's something very nice, that if I push it a little further, something that comes out of course, your interaction with the group, with the professor, but eventually you create that. You find, aha, here is something that I found. It was not something I was, because sometimes the professor tells you, do this and this experiment because we'll get the results and we'll publish them. That's what I meant by flexibility. You work in certain area, but if you do things right, you could find your own interpretation, just specifically how the laser light comes out and how it interacts with Einstein's equations and so on. So it was very rewarding in some sense. That keeps you going as a research scientist.
It sounds like the chemist version of what you said you experienced being on the field trips with the entomologists.
That's right, yes. That's right. This excitement, exactly, something new there will, yes. Not requiring a lot of math, but observation, okay, and knowing, of course, you have to know what you're doing. So, you're right.
You didn't have to fight off any snakes at Berkeley, right? So nobody had to tend to snakes, just hippies.
We did have one experience, though, not quite with snakes, but since we were working with chemical lasers and it was student unrest, I remember at some point we were very worried we had to close the lab and also, because some of the unrest was trying to find things that were going wrong. Chemical lasers, that's a weapon. So we're going to fight against that. We had nothing to do with weapons, but the army was already using some chemical lasers there because they were very powerful. So we got worried. We were in the basement, of course. But yes, that was a real threat. Okay, not snakes, but in this case, our own fellow students, if you want.
Were you involved in the writing process for publishing articles coming out of the lab?
Yes. One, particularly doing original things like this. Yes, very much so. Of course, with a lot of help from the professor, but yes, in principle, we were writing our own articles, and then of course, sometimes it was part of a larger piece of research or so. But yes, that's part of the job, to develop the skills to write scientific articles.
Did you find it difficult writing? I mean, it is a very stylized way of writing.
Yes,
yes. Was it difficult to pick that up?
Yes, I probably did. I don't remember the details anymore because probably we were so close to, in our case, to our mentor that it's not something I saw as a barrier at all, but it was just a learning process. But I do remember it must have happened quite naturally because once I became a professor afterwards, it was never a big worry. It eventually became a worry with my own students because I had some Russian students who were good, but they were writing terrible English. Okay, it's time consuming. You have to correct. You have to rewrite things. So that's something just that takes time. But you are right. It's a very special way, very, very special language, which is fine for scientific articles, but. Talking a little bit about the sort of things we're doing, it's terrible for communicating to the public, of course.
Yeah,
but it's part of your learning experience to be able to write. Not only that, it's a similar experience is to go to a conference and give talks. Okay, so it was also connected to that. You have to learn how to talk to your fellow scientists.
So I have a few questions. Some of them relate directly to the work that you're doing, but there's also an outside question. I know that you get married in 1973,
right.
And yet your description so far has been that you had no times for things outside of
right,
work.
Right.
So I am curious to know a little bit about how that came about, but I'm also one of the other questions I'm curious about is I know that you continued on to do a postdoc at UC Berkeley, and I'm wondering, I'm wondering how it was defined, you know, when your PhD really ended and when your postdoc began, because
right.
some of your work is continuing. So
right, right. It was essentially a decision of my professor, Pimentel. He said, "Hey, you've done enough. You already earned a degree, but we have these other things. So why don't you stay another year?" And it also gave me time again. As you see, I'm not very good with planning way ahead, but it gave me time to define the next step, which was going to work with Cherry Rowland. But yes, it was essentially that. He thought, you have enough for a thesis, why don't you write your thesis? Of course, if you want to leave already, I have the degree, I could have done it, but we have these several exciting things that we could, that you propose, that we could keep doing. And so that was essentially what happened. In terms of my marriage, it is, as you know, I have a second marriage now, so I did, but I lived many years, of course, with my first wife. But she was a student of George Pimentel as well, so that tells you I didn't spend too much time looking around. So we...
So were there many female students?
No, not there were not very many students, very female students at that time. I'm trying to remember. No, it was mostly male students, but there were just a couple of female students. In fact, I don't remember. I think at some point she might have been the only female student, but I don't remember exactly. That's a possibility. But then later, yeah, there were other, of course, there was no, as you know, no actual discrimination. It was just less likely for women to research at that time, which is something that fortunately changed a lot.
Mm-hmm. How did you meet Sherwood Rowland? I know it was while you were at
Yes,
Berkeley.
He was working also on chemical dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very natural. As I was telling you, it was part of our experience to go to meetings. And again, George Pimentel was a wonderful mentor in many respects. But this was one of them, that he encouraged us to write papers and to go to meetings, usually with him or so. So he would bring... So these were not large formal meetings, but meetings of... in California, for example, I remember this one. So I had met Cherry Rowland on several occasions at the meetings of this sort and had similar interests. Okay, he just had an entirely different experimental approach to learn about basically similar questions that we were posing about the nature of chemical reactions. And his approach had to do with radioactivity, so it was what's called hot atom chemistry. So you prepare with in a nuclear reactor, you can have some atoms at what tremendous speeds, but eventually they slow down, and you could study unique aspects of certain reactions. So to me, that was attractive. Hey, this is quite complementary, but it's of interest to pursue this quite academic research. Was assuming I would remain in academia if I had a chance, and working in other aspects of physical chemistry, like many of my scholars. So this was a natural thing to do, and Cherry Rowland was a very pleasant person. In these meetings, we were able to socialize a little bit and so on. So it was sort of natural to talk to him and to... I remember I did consider several others, but this was one of the most attractive experimental research groups, and again, sort of unique, interesting, something quite different that became an opportunity.
So before we move into the postdoc, I had two questions about your experiences as a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
One had to do with whether or not you were responsible or had experiences looking for funding, or was that something that the advisor does, and the graduate students don't have to.
That's
right.
Yeah. At that time, that's something I did not have any experience. I later learned, of course, you have to write proposals, and it's a little bit like writing papers. Okay, so that experience was important. But no, that part was not something I had to do while a graduate student. I mean, we were aware of some of the difficulties or the things that, some important science funding came from Department of Defense at that time. It was very fundamental physical chemistry, which was sort of strange, but it was understandable that these were important developments in science. Some other was connected with NASA. One of the other interests, George Wendell had a couple of interests, chemical lasers was perhaps what he might have been best known for, but the other one was working at very low temperatures, doing spectroscopy at very low temperatures. And so that was more connected with some peculiar properties of matter at these very low temperatures, which is why he became interested also in life on Mars. Okay. And so that's why I was telling you two sort of different, connected through the fundamental chemistry, but two very different fields, chemical lasers and chemistry at low temperatures, with all sorts of important connections from the point of view of the fundamental chemistry, looking at different aspects of that. But spectroscopy was very much at the core of these things. We became aware of that because, of course, life on Mars was one of those things that could get funded or could get a lot of attention, okay, more in the public domain rather than the fundamental chemistry we were carrying out, other than chemical lasers or so. Yeah, but that's interesting. No, in hindsight, it's not something we usually have students learn. And perhaps it's something we should. Okay,
was it surprising to you to learn what the variety of sources of funding were for the lab that Pimentel was doing?
Yes, I guess it was surprising, but then I realized what the reasons were and so on. But it was all government funding, essentially. I became aware also there's some, which at that time was a lot more, there was some funding from industrial sources, but much closer to applied research or perhaps to organic chemistry or things of that sort. So it wasn't all that important, if you want. After all, just different government agencies somehow or other financing fundamental research.
My only other question was around becoming a part of the larger community of chemists and scientists. You were talking just a few moments ago about how you met Sherry Rowland and the importance of some of the meetings that Pimentel put together, but that these were smaller smaller meetings with a lot, you know, kind of California-based. And I'm thinking about you as, you know, earlier in our discussion you said, you know, what U.S. institution, especially Berkeley, would ever have a graduate student come up from Mexico City. I'm thinking about you entering into a larger community like the American Chemical Society.
Right.
And how you experienced becoming part of that larger community as a graduate student.
That's quite interesting. I should have clarified. The smaller California meetings, that's where I had a chance to meet Sherry Rowland. But in fact, working with George, we did participate in some of these larger meetings like American Chemical Society. So it was also an Lorena, un favorzote. Me estoy quedando. A ver si me traen. No café, sino. El refresco este que tengo aquí, la mascala.
Do you want something else to drink?
Ok. occasionally something happened.
Do you want to take a short break?
No, no, we could finish at least the question. That's fine. If I just recover my voice, something got trapped. It was an interesting part of that academic experience to participate in these larger meetings. At that time, it was not that common as it is became later to have poster sessions, because there you have every student doing something. They were not that common, so it was possible for us students actually to make some presentations, or at least to listen to others, but I remember doing some presentations myself. So that was quite interesting and learning about the larger community. And after all, I had a chemical engineering background, so I knew about the industrial aspects of many of these, many of the activities of the American Chemical Society or so. But yeah, that was something interesting to do to the communication with the society at large. But one thing that was much later, of course, became, well, not that much later in my postdoc, I already did that, but it's quite unique, this, it's a special word. You communicate with a certain language and you talk to a certain group of people, so it's a little bit narrow, if you want. If you then address a real life problem, it's something you are not trained to do. You have to be able to communicate with specialists in other fields and to communicate with people in other fields as well, which is not part of the normal training in an academic environment. Mm-hmm. But that I was in some sense forced to do that with my subsequent research, the postdoctoral research, but it was not part of my PhD experience.
So, do you want to take a short break?
If you want, 5 minutes or so.
Sure.
Sure.